VOA 1, the hits.
Welcome to Learning English on the Voice of America. I'm Katie Weaver. Our 30-minute program is designed for people learning English. We speak slowly, using a simple style and limited vocabulary. Today on the show, we have reports from Brian Lynn and Alice Bryant. We close with our American History program, The Making of a Nation. But first, there is a famous picture of American civil rights leader Martin Luther King Jr. seated for a ride on a public bus in Montgomery, Alabama. The year was 1956, and King and other activists had led a boycott of that city's bus system. The movement won an end to laws that restricted Black bus riders. The picture shows King and another civil rights leader seated at the front of the bus. King is looking out the window, seemingly deep in thought. It was a victorious moment, but still very early in the fight for equality for African Americans. Ernest Withers took that picture of King, along with many others. Withers was a central documenter of the civil rights movement. He was also an informant for the United States Federal Bureau of Investigation. A new documentary film, MLK FBI, is about how the FBI sought someone close to King to watch and report on him. The film, from director Sam Pollard, shows how its two title subjects came to be enemies. Pollard shows how FBI Chief J. Edgar Hoover used the full force of the law enforcement agency to attack the nonviolent movement for civil rights in the 1960s. Wiretaps, blackmail, and informants were all used in the operations to find legal or moral wrongdoing by King. The spying was part of a wider government campaign to find and destroy suspected communist influences in the U.S. The activity against King represents the darkest part of the Bureau's history, former FBI Director James Comey says in the film. The documentary does not provide new information of major importance. There are not surprise witnesses or shocking discoveries. Most of the details, including King's sexual activities outside his marriage and the FBI's use of Withers as an informant, have been known for years. But that is not Pollard's interest. His exploration is expansive. He looks back to racist legal reforms that followed the Civil War and discusses the development of social weaponry based on Black sexuality. He explores how FBI agents were represented in popular culture as singularly powerful and just. The film is mainly based on the book The FBI and Martin Luther King Jr., From Solo to Memphis, by historian David J. Garrow. The most scandalous material comes late in the movie, after the filmmaker has presented the historical elements connecting the civil rights movement and the U.S. government. By that point, the movie is close to over. But the story of American intelligence operations that targeted Martin Luther King Jr. is suddenly very clear and frightening. King's famous speech at the March on Washington took place on August 28, 1963. 2 days later, FBI official William C. Sullivan wrote about King, "We must mark him now as the most dangerous Negro in the future of this nation." Pollard spoke to historians, reporters, and other civil rights activists of the MLK period. However, most are only heard and not seen in the movie. The director also includes short parts of old movies and a lot of music. The film's messaging, however, is restrained by something out of the director's control. It reports that King faced a real emotional crisis after the FBI sent his wife, Coretta Scott King, hurtful information about her husband. And the film points out that the FBI secretly recorded King while he was dealing with the crisis. But the movie does not present anything from the FBI tapes. Those records are sealed until at least 2027.
A new study shows a link between bad technology and higher stress levels of employees. Researchers from American computer company Dell Technologies led the study. Dell partnered with neuroscience company Emotive on the study. The research involved experiments in which brain waves were measured as people were put through a series of bad technology experiences. The experiments involved adults of many ages with different levels of computer skills. Subjects were tested with simple computer problems, like troubled sign-in operations. Others dealt with slow speed connections to the Internet. Still others experienced system crashes. The moment people started using bad technology, we saw a doubling of their levels of stress, said Olivier Houllier, president of Emotive. "I was a bit surprised by that, because you rarely see those levels going so high," he told Reuters news agency. The experiments showed that technology-related stress had a lasting effect, Houllier added. "People don't relax back into calmness quickly. It takes a long time." In addition to tech failures affecting the mental health of employees, the problems can also affect a company's business, the research found. For example, bad problems can reduce productivity, especially that of younger workers. The research showed a 30% production drop among study subjects under age 40. "Bad experiences affect you regardless of computer literacy," said Sile Montgomery, who leads customer experience efforts for Dell. "But young people seem to be even more impacted because they expect technology to work." As stressful as the tech problems were for those in the study, Houllier said, such effects were likely to be even more severe in the real world. He said the subjects knew they were involved in an experiment, so they may not have been as personally affected by the results. Ullier also said the continuing coronavirus crisis has sharply increased stress levels around the world. So, real tech problems drive up those already high stress levels. Another issue is that many employees are working remotely, and this can also add to tech difficulties. In an office, computer support helpers are usually available to help workers solve tech problems. But working from a kitchen or home office, employees are often on their own. When you're stuck at home and all you have is a computer provided by your employer, you might not have access to tech support, Ullier said. That's why it's so important, when you're remote, to have technology that works. Here are some specific findings of the study. The amount of work an employee can get done in a day can increase as much as 37% when effective technology is used, along with supporting software and services. Using good technology can save employees 23 minutes per hour. And on average, bad tech was found to interfere with employee performance by up to 30%. I'm Brian Lynn.
Farmers were digging among fruit trees on a farm on Mexico's coast when they found a big surprise, a stone statue almost 2 meters tall. The female statue may represent an influential woman rather than a goddess, or some mix of the two, experts said earlier this month. The National Institute of Anthropology and History said this was the first such statue in the Huasteca area of Mexico. The statue had a complex hairpiece and showed evidence that the female subject may have held a high status. The piece may date to around 1450 to 1521, the institute said. The place where it was found is near El Tajín, a pre-Hispanic city from the early 9th to 13th centuries. But the statue shows some influences of the Aztecs. The farmers found the piece on New Year's Day and quickly reported it to officials. The area where it was found had not been known to be an archaeological site, and the statue may have been moved from another unknown site. The person represented by the open-mouthed, wide-eyed statue remains a mystery. Institute archaeologist Maria Eugenia Maldonado Vite wrote that this could be a ruler based on her stance and clothing. She may not have been a goddess. But Maldonado said the statue could be a mix of the team goddesses and women of high political or social status in Huasteca. Those goddesses were part of a fertility cult, she said. Susan Gillespie is an anthropology professor at the University of Florida. She said Aztec documents from colonial times made note of women rulers who passed their power on to successors. Women were highly valued in the pre-Hispanic times and lost their status only after the Spanish conquest, Gillespie added. However, she noted that if there is only one such find, it's hard to say how important it is, or even if it is correctly identified. Archaeology works best with repeated findings, she explained. In 1994, at the Mayan ruin site of Palenque, archaeologists found the tomb of a woman called the Red Queen. That name came from the red color that covered her tomb, which dates to between 600 and 700 AD. But it has never been clearly established that the woman was a ruler of Palenque. I'm Alice Bryant.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. On November 11th, 1918, a truce was signed ending the hostilities of World War I. The Central Powers, led by Germany, had lost. The Allies, led by Britain, France, and the United States, had won. The war lasted 4 years. It took the lives of 10 million people. It left much of Europe in ruins. It was described as the war to end all wars. Barbara Klein and Doug Johnson tell about President Woodrow Wilson and his part in events after the war.
The immediate task was to seek agreement on terms of a peace treaty. The Allies were filled with bitter anger. They demanded a treaty that would punish Germany severely. They wanted to make Germany weak by destroying its military and industry. And they wanted to ruin Germany's economy by making it pay all war damages. Germany, they said, must never go to war again. President Woodrow Wilson of the United States did not agree completely with the other allies. He wanted a peace treaty based on justice, not bitterness. He believed that would produce a lasting peace. President Wilson had led negotiations for a truce to end the hostilities of World War I. Now, he hoped to play a major part in negotiations for a peace treaty. To be effective, he needed the full support of the American people.
Americans had supported Wilson's policies through most of the war. They had accepted what was necessary to win. This meant higher taxes and shortages of goods. At the time, Americans seemed to forget party politics. Democrats and Republicans worked together. All that changed when it became clear the war was ending. Congressional elections were to be held in November 1918. President Wilson was a Democrat. He feared that Republicans might gain a majority of seats in Congress. If they did, his negotiating powers at a peace conference in Europe would be weakened. Wilson told the nation, "The return of a Republican majority to either House of Congress would be seen by foreign leaders as a rejection of my leadership.
Republicans protested. They charged that Wilson's appeal to voters was an insult to every Republican. One party leader said, "This is not the president's private war." The Republican campaign succeeded. The party won control of both the Senate and the House of Representatives. The congressional elections were a defeat for President Wilson, but he did not let the situation interfere with his plans for a peace conference. He and the other Allied leaders agreed to meet in Paris in January 1919.
In the weeks before the conference, Wilson chose members of his negotiating team. Everyone expected him to include one or more senators. After all, the Senate would vote to approve or reject the final peace treaty. Wilson refused. Instead, he chose several close advisers to go with him to Paris. Today, American history experts say Wilson's decision was a mistake. Failure to put senators on the negotiating team, they say, cost him valuable support later on. In early December, President Wilson sailed to France. The voyage across the Atlantic Ocean lasted 9 days. He arrived at the port of Brest on December 13th. Wilson felt very happy. 13, he said, was his lucky number.
French citizens stood along the railroad that carried him from Brest to Paris. They cheered as his train passed. In Paris, cannons were fired to announce his arrival, and a huge crowd welcomed him there. The people shouted his name over and over again, "Wilson, Wilson, Wilson." The noise sounded like thunder. French Premier Georges Clemenceau commented on the event. He said, "I do not think there has been anything like it in the history of the world." People cheered President Wilson partly to thank America for sending its troops to help fight against Germany. But many French citizens and other Europeans also shared Wilson's desire to establish a new world of peace. They listened with hope as he made an emotional speech about a world in which everyone would reject hatred, a world in which everyone would join together to end war forever.
More than 25 nations that helped win the war sent representatives to the peace conference in Paris. All took part in the negotiations. However, the important decisions were made by the so-called Big Four: Prime Minister David Lloyd George of Britain, Premier Georges Clemenceau of France, Premier Vittorio Orlando of Italy, and President Woodrow Wilson of the United States. Wilson hoped the other Allied leaders would accept his plan for a new international organization. The organization would be called the League of Nations. Wilson believed the League could prevent future wars by deciding fair settlements of disputes between nations. He believed it would be the world's only hope for a lasting peace.
Most of the other representatives did not have Wilson's faith in the power of peace, yet they supported his plan for the League of Nations. However, they considered it less important than completing a peace treaty with Germany, and they did not want to spend much time talking about it. They feared that negotiations on the League might delay the treaty and the rebuilding of Europe. Wilson was firm. He demanded that the peace treaty also establish the League. So he led a group at the conference that wrote a plan for the operation of the League. He gave the plan to the European leaders to consider. Then he returned to the United States for a brief visit.
President Wilson soon learned that opposition to the League of Nations existed on both sides of the Atlantic Ocean. Many Americans opposed it strongly. Some Republican senators began criticizing it even before Wilson's ship reached the port of Boston. The senators said the plan failed to recognize America's long-term interests. They said it would take away too many powers from national governments. 37 senators signed a resolution saying the United States should reject the plan for the League of Nations. That was more than the number of votes needed to defeat a peace treaty to which Wilson hoped the League plan would be linked.
The Senate resolution hurt Wilson politically. It was a sign to the rest of the world that he did not have the full support of his people. But he returned to Paris anyway. He got more bad news when he arrived. Wilson's top advisor at the Paris Peace Conference was Colonel Edward House. Colonel House had continued negotiations while Wilson was back in the United States. House agreed with Wilson on most issues. Unlike Wilson, however, he believed the Allies' most urgent need was to reach agreement on a peace treaty with Germany. To do this, House was willing to make many more compromises than Wilson on details for the League of Nations.
Wilson was furious when he learned what House had done. He said, "Colonel House has given away everything I had won before I left Paris. He has compromised until nothing remains. Now I have to start all over again. This time it will be more difficult." For Woodrow Wilson, the most difficult negotiations still lay ahead.
And that's our show. But we'll be back tomorrow, same time, same place, with another Learning English program on the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Katie Weaver.